Howdy, y'all. You're listening to The Managing Up Show, a podcast about leading and managing in the world of technology. I'm your host, Travis Weisgood, and with me this week are Nick Means.
Hey, everybody.
And Brandon Hayes.
Hello. This week, I wanted to talk about something that I've been thinking about for a long time, something that Nick, you and I have talked about at various lunches that I kind of took with me into job interviews when I was a relatively new manager and really thought about it in my jobs and thought about it in conversations about what it means to create teams that self-manage. Essentially, like, I think the phrase you used, this is, you may not even remember this because it was like, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. You talked about managing yourself out of a job. And I thought about that a lot. You may not realize it, but it really stuck with me. And I thought about it a great deal since then. And I've used that as sort of a North Star to try to figure out what that actually means. And I've kind of coupled that topic with the idea of self-managing teams, but I don't know if they're the same thing. But I just wanted to open that up for exploration and ask you first and foremost what that means to you. What did it mean to you when you said that? And has that changed over time when you talk about managing yourself out of a job?
I don't even remember saying that. That's hilarious. It's something that I do say on a regular basis and think about on a regular basis and still is very much a North Star for me as well. In that, I have a pretty strong conviction that most management intervention should be very light touch. That if you're busy, unless a team is in crisis, if you're busy doing lots of active intervention and shifting parts of the team around and regularly mediating conflict, and you're probably overmanaging just a little bit, or you're making the team too reliant on you and not empowering them enough so that they can be reliant upon themselves. And I think that's what I really mean when I say that, is I always want to default towards empowering the team, setting a high standard, making sure everybody knows what's expected, but then giving the team broad latitude in figuring out the best way to achieve that goal.
So maybe, Travis, you could answer this part. Where is the difference between letting go of stuff that you need to let go of to let a team self-manage and like just abdicating your actual job responsibility?
I think that's a very, very blurry line at best, because it's going to really depend on the makeup of the team and the people who are on it, people who are around it, the people they're responsible to. I know for me, the majority of the time that I've had what I would call an unequivocal success in self-managing teams, it's very much serving as sort of the person pointing them in the right direction. And then what do you need me to do to support this? And throwing it back on them. Those teams have been largely more senior teams. I don't want to say it's stacked with a bunch of staff engineers and a principal as the lead or anything like that, but people who have done this for more than a couple of years. And they also tend to be people who care about their craft a lot and care about the product a lot. So I think it's, for me, finding all of those is a good indicator that that's a team that you should really try giving a little bit more control to. I know I've actively caught myself in the past having to say, okay, you know what? I'm starting to recognize some of those things where I'm feeling like I'm being a little dependent or depended on by the team. So how do I step back? And it can feel really uncomfortable, short of just being underwater yourself. If you're in a company where you're stretched too thin, I've always found it's such a relief when you can start pushing more and more off to the team and let the team take over more and more control of what they're doing, and kind of just keeping a check. Are they still heading in the right direction? Are they moving in the right direction? And that's taken a lot off of my plate. But when things are moving smoothly and you don't have any huge deadlines or you're not stretched too thin, that's when I find myself interjecting a little bit more than I probably should. And it starts to feel a little uncomfortable. And I always use how comfortable I feel as an indicator as to whether or not this is something I really need to investigate and like move into or not. And generally when it's like, well, I'm giving up too much control, I'm putting too much on the team, that's generally a spot for me to say, okay, hang on, let's actually look at this. Am I?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting distinction for us to call out, because I think this is one of the counterintuitive things that trips everybody up in their first management role. This idea that you don't want a team to be overly dependent upon you as the manager. It's sort of, you know, you get this job, nobody gives you a lot of training. They tell you, here's your team, here's your feature to ship in 6 months, have at it. And the temptation is to jump in both hands, both feet, and try to guide the team toward that deadline, when often that's not what a team needs from you. They need more context setting. They need to understand what that deadline actually means. They might need, if they're on the younger end of the spectrum, they might need some help breaking that work down and figuring out how to break it into manageable milestones and chunks to get them there. But they generally don't need you, at least this is my theory that I'd love to throw out to test. They generally don't need you to be the one chopping the work up, putting it in the backlog in a stack, and having them pull off and managing it to that degree of precision.
That's a really hard thing to push back on sometimes too, especially if you're relatively new to managing, because you have to learn to say no to people that want you to do things a certain way. That people have a mental model of what a manager is and should do from prior managers that they've worked with and other managers maybe that are your peers or whatever, or maybe somebody you came in and replaced. And people have this, and they need what they need. And so people will come to you a bunch and say, hey, XYZ person isn't doing this thing that I feel like as a manager, you should expect of them. You should really talk to them and, you know, help them do XYZ. And you're like, man, that's weird, because I really trust that person and I feel like they're on it. And your instinct is like, man, I thought we'd covered this. And you're going to want to second guess yourself and kind of become more involved in certain things based on a lot of people both above and below you and to the side are going to come at you and have ideas about the amount of management you should be doing. You're not going to get a lot of encouragement from other people to step back, I guess is what I'm saying in short. And that can make this process really difficult. And your team notices. They notice if you step in. They notice these little mini signals of stepping in and taking control. It's viewed as sort of lower trust. And so like answering the question of like, well, why would you take your hands off the steering wheel? And I think that's a big one.
Well, I think that's, you just hit on one of the key things in a manager's tool belt, like actually stepping in and taking a more active role. If you've built up a team and given them a lot of room to work on their own and self-direct, it should be viewed as okay, wait, what's wrong here? Why did Brandon just get really involved in our planning meeting? Now, ideally, you're not doing that in a vacuum. Ideally, that's not something that you just randomly show up and like all of a sudden you've got a opinion on every card they're talking about. People know why you're there, but that can be the reinforcement to the conversations that hopefully have been being had over the previous weeks, maybe months even, to say, okay, this is really serious now. There's somebody in the room who's not normally here. And if you're just involved in the day-to-day minutiae, you kind of forfeit that ability to do that and create an environment where it feels like there's lower trust.
Yeah, one of the distinctions for me is making sure that I have my own purpose and objective if I do get involved, mm-hmm. so that I can explain it. I think that may be the most dangerous part of letting somebody else kind of like coerce you and, you know, hey, I don't understand why you're not taking a more active role in these planning sessions and breaking the work down more. And you should be creating these JIRA tickets and whatever. And well, here's my plan. This is what I'm doing. Here's why I'm doing it. But here's a person telling me I should be doing this way. And then when somebody pushes me on that and says, hey, why are you this involved? I don't want to explain it because I don't like the reason for it. And so, you know, if you find yourself in a sort of indefensible position like that, I think that's one way that it's like a signal that I might be overmanaging. If I'm managing for the perception, you know, I'm managing to a perception that I'm managing,
yeah.
that other people see me managing in a very public way. I'm involved in the Slack channels and commenting on the JIRA tickets. And it's not that you shouldn't have any of that. But if you do, you better have your own reasons for it. You know, hey, I really want to stay on top of this because this fits into this thing. And having an extra pair of eyes on that is really important right now. Or I'm, you know, it's contextually relevant to some other stuff I'm thinking about right now, and not just sort of literally supervising somebody doing their work as they open pull requests. So that's an easy pit to fall. It's not even a trap. It's a pit, because I think everybody winds up just kind of driving into that one.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are valid reasons, though. Like you said, there are valid reasons for being close to it sometimes. And you have to be able to explain that when it's necessary. I mean, it's, you know, there's sometimes that you have a team that's working on something that's super high visibility. And if you're not there to observe the work and give the updates up your chain, then your chain is going to come to the team for those updates. Mm-hmm. And so being able to explain, hey, I'm just here to support you and to carry the administrative burden of this project and make sure the people upstream from us have the status that they need to be able to trust that we're going to deliver. Just carry on. I trust you is a nice thing to be able to say.
Yeah, for sure. One of the directions that you can get pushed from that you mentioned, Brandon, was from the side. And I'm curious for y'all's experience, because that's been an area where I've probably received the most pushback, I guess you could call it, against being really hands-off with a team. And it generally comes from not necessarily other engineering teams, but other teams that are adjacent, whether that's...
Right, your product partner or... Yeah.
I've had this happen with sales, where like they've got a feature that there was a contract that there's a clause in the contract that if this feature doesn't get shipped on this date, the whole contract is void. And they're looking at that and just sweating it and be like, okay, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? I need to know. So I've seen it come from all things or from all different angles, but generally outside of engineering. But how do you push back against that? I think it's everybody's gut instinct on this is, okay, I don't feel like I have control. I need more control. Let me tighten that control. What can I do to control? Well, I can't program, but I can sure ask people things. So how do you push back against that and help move that in a healthy direction so that everyone else is more aware of the thing that I think from the conversation we're having here, the three of us, and I would imagine a lot of our listeners take as almost self-evident.
So for me, it goes back to what I said just prior to you asking that question. I think usually that kind of intervention can be read as a signal that that party needs more information. And if you can over-deliver that information, if you can get them to a point where they feel comfortable, then you can do that in a way without having to intervene in the team. Maybe you have to get a little bit closer to gather the information that they're asking for. Maybe you push back on it to some degree because the details that they're asking for are really not things that they should be concerned about. And you have to find delicate and careful ways to push back on that and teach them more about the way that you engineering manage. But by and large, it seems to be a cry for more information every time I've experienced it.
Yeah. And that can, you know, giving them extra information is a big one. I've learned a cadence that works for that is generally weekly. Any more frequently than that, and it's too thrashy. So you sort of summarize, hey, here's what's going on. Here's whether this thing is on track. Here's, you know, here's where we are. Here's my confidence interval that we're going to make this thing. But the lesson running all the way up to them might be, hey, you shouldn't have done that. Don't do that. Don't sell something with that isn't built without consulting the engineering team first.
Yeah.
And I'm very sorry that that's the situation that we're in, but also, you know, there may be some actual, you know, tough feedback that needs to come back to the people that did this, that created the situation. Unless it's something that was agreed upon, and you know, even then, basically moving it from, hey, we're all in the same boat and we're going to learn some lessons together, and we may not like everything that we learn, but we are going to do our best. And if you have that baseline of trust, I can tell you, I'll bust out my signature phrase and I can tell you what not to do. Don't cave completely. From an experience I had earlier on in my management career, where I was so fixated on pleasing the stakeholders. I have a very high level of stakeholder empathy by default. I think partially because I ran a business, I have a lot of empathy for people who are trying to make the business make money and hire people to do stuff. And then they're like, hey, where's the stuff I'm hiring you to do? And I know that's, you know, that's sort of the contract, and I feel very sensitive to that. And so in the past, I've caved too early to some of those types of things. And so that's why you hear me being a little bit forceful in my pushback, because I've experienced the consequences of the opposite. And at one point, I literally had a program manager who would come over to the engineers' desks and call impromptu stand-ups 2 to 3 times a day, quote-unquote stand-ups, so that he could get status updates on up to the minute. He would interrupt the engineer's work 3 times a day so that he can get hour by hour status updates on where they were with all the features they were building for something that was absolutely business critical, which is a piece of software that does not exist anymore in a company that does. So like, I am super jaded about this at this point, but I completely caved on this. The engineers were miserable. We experienced turnover. This was like very poor management on my part. You know, you talk about over-management. This was, you know, office space self-parody territory. And I, you know, I'm complicit. I totally participated in that environment because I didn't know how to dig out of that hyper management mode, that hyper supervisory, low trust, high pressure, low context environment, and try to just hold everything together like a superhero instead of divesting myself of the responsibility for all those things by handing it to the team piece by piece and entrusting that to them.
So if you found yourself in that kind of situation, let's say you're a new manager listening to the podcast and you're recognizing maybe not quite to office space parity level yet, but getting close. What are some concrete steps you can take to pull yourself out of that? Let me rephrase the question a little bit. What are some concrete steps that you would take now if you found yourself in that situation that you didn't take then?
I would renegotiate the contract, because a contract that requires multiple touch points per day tells me that we have created a situation that's not tenable at all. That's just not how software development works. I know that we've talked about this in the past, Travis, and you've worked on projects that do have like intraday release schedules and things like that. But I would say that's so far in the minority that I would have renegotiated and established a new baseline and said, okay, hold on. We've completely failed to plan here. Like, we should at least be able to predict week to week what needs to be shipped and what can be shipped. And I would I think Nick said it best when he said, you can overshare context and information and radiate that back out to people, but give a reasonable bubble of space. Those stand-ups are not for program managers to supervise. And that wasn't what that person did, by the way. the essentially project managers to supervise the, you know, a 3-day long Gantt chart with 30 things in it. That's not what stand-ups are for. And first and foremost, like giving things their job. Hey, we have a process. This process isn't actually broken, but the process, we're not using it right. So I would probably establish those boundaries first and then give a little bit of elbow room to the engineering team so that they can work and function. Because I know that like there was so little oxygen in that room that they couldn't breathe long enough to actually ship anything. And it actually made everybody go slower. And so being able to have that conversation and say, hey, you know, if you want us to go faster, I'm going to be, radiating a lot of information to you, but it's not going to be this multiple times per day thing. You're going to get really solid twice a week updates from me on where we are on stuff. And that's going to be this relative scope of our commitments. In even in that high pressure environment. And I've worked in much healthier environments as well, where you have a lot more play in that. And weekly updates are, I ran a business for 3 years off of weekly updates, being completely fine in extremely high dollar, high pressure scenarios. Weekly updates feels like the right cadence to me.
What if it's not? How do you push back on it if you have a stakeholder that, despite getting solid weekly updates from you, still is interfering in with the team, maybe having stand-ups multiple times per day at the engineers' desks? What do you do?
That's a good question.
I would take it a step further than that. Like, what do you do when there are people involved in the stand-up who shouldn't be because of that lack of space? Like, the lack of space has been created. And then as you try to create that space, you're getting pushback. It's one of those things, once you've given a little bit of room and all of a sudden you have random people involved in the stand-up who maybe should or shouldn't be there, if you try to say, okay, we need to like have this reset conversation. I've yet to have one of those that hasn't received a lot of pushback. So other than standing your ground, is there a way to kind of find that happy medium that provides something to the state? Generally, it's some sort of stakeholder who's involved in the process who probably isn't helping the process along. But how do you create that space for them to get what they feel that they need, but also buy that breathing room for your team?
So you said the magic phrase, though, whatever it is that they feel that they need. And I've learned through extremely painful experience not to guess at that. I'm a pretty good guesser at that stuff. And I thought that carried me a long way in my career. And it turns out I probably could have gotten a lot farther, a lot faster just by asking. I'm a guesser by nature. I'm like, oh, that person's probably feeling this. And my guesses are pretty good. And that saves me from having to have a conversation with somebody. You know, it also works as a conversation with somebody. It's fine. And you can say, hey, what is it that you're hoping to accomplish? Because let me tell you what the cost is. The cost is it makes the team not feel like they're trusted. And I'll tell you what, it makes me feel like I'm not trusted. And I trust the team and I need you to trust me that I can, you know, that is a methodology that will work here. And depending on how firm you have to set that boundary, because it might just be, hey, what is it that you're trying to accomplish here? And they explain, well, I'm really looking to understand what the team is doing. You know, it may be a very gentle conversation, or you may have to go all the way to, well, let me explain what the consequences of what you're doing are that you may not see. I think this literally may be the first time we're describing managing up in the Managing Up podcast. This is not a topic that we really covered a lot, but there are things where you wind up actively having to manage people that may have more organizational power than you. And to me, that would be a scenario where you're like, oh, okay, I'm managing up now. This is a thing. I have to imagine that y'all have experienced something like that in the past, or where you've had to sort of either create that space or learn to live with it and manage the team through one of those times of trial.
Yeah, I've definitely had the experience where I've seen it's tended to be folks in the product sphere who are a little overzealous with their duties. And it tends to also to be a place where there's a title mismatch. So you're bringing a team in and there may be a director or a VP involved, but the only person that's involved in, okay, what are we going to ship this sprint that has manager in their title is product manager. So that creates an automatic power imbalance, whether folks there recognize it or not. And the team just abdicates, here, you're the person who tells us what to do. You're the manager. And if you have the wrong type of personality that takes advantage of that, you just end up in a spiral where it's okay, so what tickets do I work on today? In its worst instances, I've seen it where people come up for air after they finish a ticket. Okay, what should I work on next? And the PM is like, here's your ticket.
Yeah.
I've had conversations with product managers before, pretty frank ones, that most developers don't want to have, because I think most of us are, at least the people I'm around, are very craft minded. It's like, if you're just going to write out tickets and give them to somebody and say, you go do this, you go do that, you go do this, we probably shouldn't have our development on shore. We could save a lot of money and increase our output if that's what the work we're going to do. We're not going to get as good a work. That's my thing.
That's some pretty deep game theory. You're playing chicken with your CTO about offshoring your whole team. Like, I don't know. I've been on teams where I wouldn't play that gambit.
I've played it. I've yet to have anybody say, oh, you know what? You're right. Let's just offshore it. But I mean, this is a legitimate conversation to have at a certain point. If your product team is going to like basically just build a paint by numbers Jira board, we don't need creativity in that point. And I feel like that's a lot of what we're doing when we co-locate a team and put everybody together and say, okay, we're gonna do all these things that require really highly paid people in a particular place. Why would we go down that path?
I don't know that co-location even plays into it, because you can have great product management even for a distributed team.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's easier and requires less process, so that it ends up being that that's what people are doing.
Yeah.
But I totally believe you can do that and have people scattered to the four winds of the earth.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely a hot spot that can become adversarial in a hurry between engineering leadership and product leadership. And this is the reason why, because there are so many different ways to define work and to give the team the context that they need to execute on work, all the way from the paint by numbers you're talking about to really broad sweeping 2-year product plans that don't help the engineering team figure out what's priority number one. And so, you know, one of the things that you have to do to prevent that is to spend a lot of time with your product manager and get that dialed in and figure out how to deliver the right level of context to the team so that they can be successful. If you've got a good product management counterpart, they'll want to partner with you every time, because they will see you as an ally in getting the features that they want delivered into the product delivered. If you have a product manager that doesn't trust you, they're going to move towards paint by numbers. And so it's very much an ongoing conversation that you have to kind of guide that relationship and get it to the right spot for that particular team.
And that's the kind of work that you do that's sort of invisible. When we talk about self-managing teams, I wouldn't ask any one developer on the team to take the lead on having those types of conversations, right? To create that space, I want to shift the conversation forward toward like, okay, what does a self-managing team look like and what are they doing? Because I don't think it's that. I think even if you have a self-managing team, you need a manager to be managing some of those relationships and then fishing context from outside the team. And then you can actually create the space for yourself to do that by having some of the internal workings of the team become more self-managing. I'm curious to know what that looks like on a team that's really like humming really well.
I think one of the clearest indicators I can point to when I see this working well on a team is you never see an engineer sitting around wondering what to do next. And it's not, I mean, because if you take that paint by numbers approach, there's going to be times that the backlog gets drawn completely down and you have engineers standing there looking at the board, scratching their head going, okay, what's the next task? If a team is self-managing well, the engineers will take the initiative to go figure out what's next if they don't know. And if they can't figure it out, they probably have a generally good idea of what they can do that's going to add value anyway. And they're going to dig into some technical debt project that they need to get on or some bit of remediation that needs to happen until they do figure out what the next product priority is. So that's one of the signals that I always find myself looking for.
It's interesting that you sort of would use a signal that they're not asking, like the absence of the question, what do I do next? Because that what that tells me is that it really varies from team to team. How attainable this idea is of a self-managing team. Because there are some people at some either skill levels or interest levels that really just mostly want to be given things to do. And they like being given challenging technical projects, but they may not have yet developed the skill or don't care to develop the skill of surfacing high value projects. And in fact, when in the absence of high value projects, we'll really throw a lot of effort into low value projects. I think, you know, I want to be clear, like I do tend to trust people, but I don't necessarily trust people in a vacuum and in isolation of all context. And so there's a little bit of additional contextualization you have to do to sort of like make sure that those people know where the guardrails are in terms of business value and then exercise some judgment from there. But I do agree though, that like in to a large degree, people being able to have, in fact, maybe that's a prerequisite that you have to have enough context infused into the team that they all generally know where value is. Because I think everybody's worked on teams. I know I have. I've worked on teams where value is not just elusive, it's just invisible. That from the top down, any value that you could generate is you'd have to just completely from scratch, you know, invent invent the universe first. And that's not a fair thing to ask of an engineer. And that's where, I think maybe that's where you cross into like total abdication of a manager's job. And I've said this before, and it's a really tough thing to kind of have to say, that I've been in situations where I wish I could furlough the team and just put them on paid vacation for 2 months while the business figures out what its actual priorities are, rather than create 2 months of technical debt by building these crystal castles to nowhere that don't have any doors or windows in them because the engineers don't have any idea of where the business value actually is. And I've been in situations like that, though, where I have involved the engineering team. And it's really been fascinating, actually, to pull an engineering team into the process of discovering where business value is when it is deeply, deeply elusive. They've stepped up in ways that surprised me. Literally talking to customers, fishing out business value, writing user stories, kind of playing the product role. And with the knowledge that, hey, man, I just want to code. And I'm like, I know, but this is the stuff in between you and coding, you know, bear with it. It's going to get better. You're going to start coding again soon. And you'll be a better coder because you went through this experience. I wouldn't ask that person to do this for a living. That's probably a reasonably extreme case scenario, but I have seen it.
Yeah, I think that's a good clarification. I do think that in order to get to that place where engineers aren't standing around staring at the board going, what next? You do have to have that deep infusion of context and deep setting of vision so that the team knows where they're going over the short term and the long term. And yeah, that's an excellent call out that if you don't have that, then yeah, the work that the team finds to do may not be the work that you would actually want them to do. So it's not something, even in a self-managing team, when things do generally hum along, it doesn't mean that you step out and completely ignore the team. You do still need to stay close enough to understand what is being prioritized and make sure that is actually delivering business value. And if it's not, then that's when you step in and realize that there's some context that the team is missing.
So now that you've managed yourself out of a job, because you did such a good job, what do you do with your time? Are you baking cookies and sending them to your team members? Like, what's the day-to-day job of a manager who's sort of like managed themselves out of a job?
I don't know. When I get there, I'll tell you.
It's Zeno's paradox.
I think that's a great question. I think that, you know, the thing is, building self-managing teams are one of the things that allow you to scale yourself. I've had a pretty heavy load of direct reports here for the last couple of quarters. And one of the things that has been key to me being able to do that and to take that load that the business needed me to take on temporarily was that my teams have been pretty well set up to continue down this trajectory. They know the business value we're trying to deliver. They understand the features that we're trying to deliver. And by and large, can keep running for extended periods of time without any attention from me and know to come and get me when they need me.
Yeah.
And so I think that's ultimately what it is it lets you scale yourself into either more broadly, so you can help sustain more teams when the business needs you to, or it helps you scale yourself vertically and move towards that director role where you're helping guide a larger functional area of the business and helping sort out strategy and helping figure out the right things you need to be doing architecturally to set yourself up to be able to deliver product value in 6, 9, 12 months. But I think ultimately a self-managing team is a path towards scaling yourself as a manager.
One thing that's struck me recently about scaling yourself as a manager, and you talk about moving more into that director role, I will tell you, historically, there are things that I love and things that I hate in my natural state. I love people and I love conversations and I love working with people and applying logic to help them discover their own capabilities in a way that they might not have before, including their own ability to resolve their own conflicts and stuff like that. And I love that. And those are some of the things that make teams more self-managing. Some of the things that I'm good at are things that make teams more self-managing, because you can kind of, that's the coaching aspect, I would say, probably more than the other skills. Like, you can do a lot of remediation and a lot of conflict resolution directly or whatever, but it's the coaching aspect of things, which I love, you can help make teams more self-managing. There are a couple of things I hate and historically I'm not great at, and that is process and data. And it turns out those are a couple other things that are wildly necessary, I think, if you're going to get teams to be more self-managing. Getting teams to sort of be willing to shake hands with processes and apply, like you mentioned earlier, light process, but as light a process as you can that still bears the weight of a team actually using it is one of them. And then maybe data isn't wildly necessary as processes, but man, I've seen some really cool stuff happen when I've worked with managers that have a very different style to mine, where literally what they'll do is, I've seen a manager that while I was going around trying to make sure everybody was like hyped up and motivated about getting all this stuff done, this manager would post a screenshot of the burndown chart in Slack every day, every morning, clockwork. Here's the burndown chart. Here's where we are. Here's the, you know, number of stories that are stuck that haven't been started yet. And people go, oh yeah, that is stuck because of this and this. Like, people would just engage with the data and no, it wasn't personal. It was, hey, we sit, you know, here's where we are. It's a signpost. It's a, you know, that's our speedometer. There was a talk recently from the Lead Dev conference, and one of the points in it was, you know, use your gauges. And I think using your gauges is an important, important aspect of scaling yourself as a manager, because your intuition will kind of lie to you a little bit and be like, oh, everything's probably fine. Oh, no, it's not fine.
Yeah.
So those are things I'm thinking about a lot more lately as I've been pushed into those moments of scale. I'm curious to know, like, what you're doing to scale yourself, Nick, because you know, I know you've been kind of like, in the past, you've been pushed kind of further than is typical for a manager in terms of number of reports and amount of responsibility. So, like, what do you put in place that lets you sort of, I don't know, swim the avalanche? I'm trying to think of like a nonviolent metaphor to this, and I'm bad at that.
I mean, I think, and this is something I did before I joined GitHub, so I'm not saying this just because I work at GitHub. I really like the GitHub contribution graph a lot. Not that I manage by it. I use it to spot problems, because if you see a big gap in somebody's contribution history, there's probably something going on that's slowing them down. They're stuck on something. They probably need a conversation and a nudge to figure out what exactly is going on. So that's one of the things when I'm a little bit more stretched and removed. That's one of the tools that I use to look for problems. I also do my best to prioritize one-on-ones, because that is absolutely critical signal, especially when you're stretched further than you want to be. It's one of those things that's easy to compromise on until you get bit by. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you know, you punt somebody's one-on-one down the road by a couple of weeks, and the next thing you know, you're sitting in a conversation and they're telling you why they're leaving the company.
Yeah.
And so that is the other non-negotiable for me. I do not cancel one-on-ones. I reschedule them. And then the other thing that I'll call out is I've been fortunate through this period to work with some really exceptional product management partners. And leading these teams has often felt more like co-leading than it has felt like a burden on my shoulders. And that's a really fortunate place to be.
That makes a huge difference. It does. When you have a partner that's, you're kind of painting the vision together, letting the team know where the North Star is, fishing context, explaining why this matters and who it matters to, where the value is specifically. And then you can let individual people on the engineering team sort of negotiate. Mm-hmm. Hey, if this is where the value is, why am I doing all this? Couldn't I just do this? And they're like, no, here's why you actually can't do that. Or, wow, no, I guess I hadn't really thought of that. Is that easier? Yes, it's easier. Oh, okay. And you deliver early. And it's really cool.
I feel like I watch that conversation happen multiple times a week right now. And it's one of the things that makes me happiest in the world.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, I don't, this is going to come across too paternalistic, but it's so wonderful to see people that you kind of coach through something start doing things on their own and maybe doing them better than you would do it. I find that really gratifying.
What else is there? What other signals should we be looking at when we're in this situation? Because I know you've been in situations where you've been stretched pretty thin as well, Brandon.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I learned the one-on-one thing the hard way, where I've learned, you know, you can shorten them, but don't eliminate them. And even moving them to every other week, I found really, you know, at a certain point I had to go to every other week instead of every week, which I dramatically prefer. But missing, you know, you're on vacation, then they're on vacation, and you're like, we haven't talked for 7 weeks. I don't know what's going on. Oh, everything's on fire? Oh no, okay. Wow, I guess I, you know, that shouldn't have surprised me, but I'm surprised. Yeah, I would say that was a, not just from a signal perspective, that was a really, really valuable lesson. I don't mess around with that. Other signals that the team is, I think it's my nature where I look for negative stuff instead of positive signals. So this conversation is like encouraging me to look for these positive signals and reward and reinforce that instead of just look for things that indicate things might be off track. But I do look for, I have to use data at a certain point.
Yeah.
Hey, velocity, tickets getting stuck and working for a really long time, stuff getting left behind. The other thing I look for is quiet. If it's too quiet for too long, that worries me, because I look for a certain amount of interaction, because I don't think any person on my team could or would deliver an entire feature to a customer all by themselves. I just don't think that's how that works. There's usually some amount of collaboration necessary to do that. And so if people go really dark on me for a while, and I'm not sure what that length of time is, but actually for me, it feels like if I don't hear from somebody on Slack or in conversation for a day or day and a half, I wonder what's going on. And it might be just, hey, they're in focus mode and that's cool. But 2 days is like, that's weird. Something weird is going on. And so I look for people kind of going dark, and I might just reach out and say, hey, what's going on? You know, wondering how you're doing. Is everything cool? Need anything? One signal that I try not to structure stand-ups or check-ins where they could go this way. But if you hear from a check-in like three consecutive days, same as yesterday, we have a problem. That's not, you know, that's not everything's fine. That's actually something's not working right. How's that build server thing you've been stuck on for 3 days? I'm trying to think of other signals, but like when things are going really well, it's like you described, you see these autonomous signals of value that a conversation happened that moved the product forward in some way. And sometimes I won't do anything and I'll just hear an echo come in from another team that, hey, just wanted you to know, you know, such and such person reached out to me and had a really great conversation with them. And it was really cool. And I'm like, that's like, okay. Yeah. I mean, that wasn't a homework assignment. This is just a person really caring a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it is. Like what I'm looking for are signals that people care. Mm-hmm. And are invested. And you can't care about something that doesn't have a point. And so if you do the job up front, and this is, people think I'm nuts when I come in and do this, and I'm like, what's the big picture stuff? And they're like, oh my gosh, this guy's got like such a bias for big picture stuff. And it's like, no, I just know that you can't get a team to give a crap if you don't do that first, if they're not rooted in that. Because they're too smart. They're too jaded. They'll be cynical about short-term goals. Here's our, you know, two-month objective and, or here's our, you know, sprint goal or whatever. If I can help orient, and like you said, having a great product partner is so essential for this. And maybe you already have this when you show up because your product person's so great. And sometimes you have to kind of work through it to find it. But if you can paint that picture, a lot of the care naturally flows from that. Like when you take the pressure off of, oh crap, I am, you know, my job's in danger because we're not delivering any value and I secretly know this, that creates so much interpersonal conflict that just magically dissipates when you can say, hey, everyone here has a really important job to do on this really important thing and we're all collectively working toward it. Like 2/3 of the stuff that you wind up having to clean up as a manager goes away. And so I think just solving that problem first, where I guess a signal for me would be, every person on the team can clearly articulate to me or someone else what the value of the thing that they're working on a month-to-month scale is. This month, I'm working on this, and here's why it matters. If every person on the team can articulate that, I'm going to have way lower touch needs with them for that time period. It's when that's hard to get a hold of that you wind up having to resolve a lot of conflicts about, well, I don't like their code. They're using dependencies that I don't like and whatever. And you're like, oh, you don't have anything important to do. So you're bickering about bike shed stuff. That's normal, but it's not great. And I'm not going to solve that problem. I'm going to go solve the bigger problem. That's the, you know, the systemic reason that we're doing this.
Yeah. Let's go build a nuclear reactor instead of the bike shed next to it.
Yeah. I mean, that's our job, right? We're not paid to build bike sheds. I mean, I have been, and it's fun. So let's not do too much psychoanalysis on this with me. I've got a therapist, I'm working on it, but I do find myself in jobs often being very needed. And I've historically found that really gratifying to be super needed. And then I find, oh, and I don't like being this needed. And I think I've worked my way out of a lot of that, but I'm really curious if you know or have ideas for how to kind of dig out of being in that space where you're needed, you know, either hour to hour, day to day, where you can't sort of disengage and let the team kind of operate itself. How do you take actual steps toward allowing a team to manage themselves?
I mean, I think one of the first things that you have to do is look at your own reactions to being needed, because a lot of times you're doing things unconsciously that reinforce that. You're praising somebody for bringing that question to you. You're giving them an answer instead of coaching them through finding the answer. You're setting the team up to depend on you in a lot of ways. But also, and perhaps more critically, when somebody on the team does take that step towards being a little bit more independent, how do you react? Because if you're operating from that default mindset where you really want to be needed, it's really easy to pop into protectionistic mode and wondering why the team did something without consulting you. And you can take away the team's autonomy without ever meaning to, just by reacting that way. I did this very recently to one of my teams when they instituted a process change, and I had to walk what I said initially back and go, you know what? I said I wish that I'd been in that meeting. I didn't really mean that. Now that I took a break and thought about it a little bit more, I really appreciate the step that y'all took, and you resolved a big problem on the team. And I'm very thankful that you took the initiative to do that. And it was hard for me to do that because it was very much a relinquishing of control on my part. And it took a lot of, you know, sometimes you have to set that interrupt in your brain where You have the thing rolling around in your head and you have to stop it before it comes out your mouth. And I think that's what this looks like in a lot of ways, is when somebody does take that step, being able to get that interrupt in place to praise them for doing that versus saying, why didn't you include me in the meeting? Because that's often our first instinct.
I think if we were to spend an hour talking about this, you'd probably draw a line between all of them and come up with what you just said, which is the relinquishing of control. I can think of an example in the last week where I am a fan of public accountability. And so I told the team to hold me accountable. Hey, I'm instituting this thing, but the way that I'm going to do it is I'm going to talk to everybody on the team, and then I'm going to bring everybody together, and I'm just going to reflect what was said to me. And if you catch me injecting my opinions into this, that's a bug, not a feature. And I want you to hold me accountable for that. My job is to collect all of these things and then reflect them back to you and ask you what you want to do with it collectively as a team. And I'm out. I'm stepping out of this conversation. And this is my, you know, this is my favorite type of conversation. And I'm opting out of it. Like, that's my, it feels like I'm giving a gift, but it's actually necessary. Because I could run that. I could massage it into exactly what I know it should be, but I can't get anybody else to care about it as much as I would, because I made it up and not them. And so letting it, like literally letting a team start doing some of the management tasks, like setting some of the team norms and deciding how they want to operate as a team in ways that don't negatively impact anything. And I think I heard somewhere once that this is like our old Richard Bransonism, that if somebody can do a job 70% as well as you would do it, just don't even correct them. And I think about it in terms of an order of magnitude. If a thing that you're going to delegate to an individual team member or the team overall, like, hey, y'all come up with a schedule for our meetings. We have people scattered across all these time zones, and I can't come up with a thing that's going to satisfy everyone. Here's an idea. Y'all come up with a schedule, like a rotating schedule or something that all of you are bought into, and I will be there. And if I can't be there because I'm taking a kid to school or whatever, then I won't be there and we can figure it out. But I'm not going to control that aspect of how the team runs. I can't care about that and also claim to let a team self-manage. So I'm in the process of relinquishing some of that control right now, and it's difficult every time you do it. Maybe it gets easier. I don't know.
I don't think it does.
Oh, great.
I think it stays hard.
I think to scale this down to like, okay, so you're a lead dev on a team, or maybe this is the first, like you're a manager with training wheels. Like something as simple as, when was the last time that code was merged and or shipped that you weren't involved in the review? Like trying to make sure that the team can ship things without you being intimately involved in every step of the process. That's one of the very first steps. Like even before you can get to the point where you're talking about changing a process or setting meeting dates or things like that. Being able to step away from the thing that you at some point have probably prided yourself on being involved with. How can you say, hey, it's an achievement that this thing shipped and I saw the feature when everybody else did. I didn't get in and dig into the code and offer my point of view on it.
Yeah, I think another thing that I found helpful and a relatively easy thing to hand off is team rituals. It's very easy to ask somebody on the team to lead an iteration planning or to lead a retro or something like that. And I think that falls into that Richard Branson quote that you just said. Most everybody on the team can probably do those things 70% as well as you. And guess what? If they don't, you're there to help them out. It's okay. It's part of growing, and it gives everybody on the team a chance to sort of rotate through doing a little bit of leadership for a very short, approachable amount of time. And it shows them that you don't have to be in control of everything, and is a good signal to get people to step out in other places and other ways as well.
Yeah, you can tell people all day that you trust them, but it's those moments that actually show them. And you can, you know, I've been told by people, hey, I really trust you. And then I've been showed the opposite. And what do you think I believed? Like, nope. No, you don't. And not only that, now I don't necessarily trust that you're a person of integrity because you say one thing and then do a different thing. And the worst part is I know I'm guilty of that as a manager. So that's something to be really careful about, is really what you talk about when you say I'm going to create a self-managing team or I'm going to manage myself out of a job. It means that I'm going to build so much trust with the team and pass them so much context that I genuinely believe that if I didn't come in for a month, I would come back and things would be okay. And then I don't know what, you know, that everything else I produce in that time frame is gravy from that point, or I can take on more or whatever. Like there's no downside to that. You just have to be really deliberate about that relinquishment.
And I don't know that you even always get the chance to build the trust. I think sometimes you have to start from that place of trust and show the team that you trust them by default. And if they show you that you've given them too much, then you walk it back a little bit, but you don't clamp it down. And hopefully you find a place where you've put just the right amount of touch in place for where the team is so that you can grow them to where you want them to be. But I think you have to start by over-trusting rather than under-trusting if you want to get there.
I totally agree with that. And it's actually what I ask of teams. And when I've come into multiple low-trust environments and said, the way to bootstrap trust is benefit of the doubt. And we're going to give each other the benefit of the doubt. And we have to start there. Hey, I think you're probably capable of this. And in those cases, people will prove you right most of the time. It's really interesting. People will stretch themselves and they might say, hey, I did this thing and it worked out fine, but I actually didn't like it and I don't want to do that again. And that's fine. You learn something that's, you know, it's cool. There's so much cool stuff happens when you start from that place, but it's really hard. It's not 101 level management stuff, even though it probably should be. It should be the first thing you learn about, not, you know, I think most people that get into management come in from a different angle where they learn the processes and rituals and, well, I'm a developer that's been Scrum trained and I know something about Scrum mastering and I know this and I know, and I've interviewed a few people. I can probably make it as a hiring manager. You're like, oh no, you're going to get your lunch eaten for about 2 years. I mean, I know I did. So if you're faster than 2 or 3 years, let me know. I'd love to sign up for your newsletter on how you did that faster.
Well, and it's, you know, this is a trope we've returned to again and again, but the idea of the manager who gets into management because they want more control, that is not what you get as a manager, because actually in practice, you have so much less control over individual humans than you like to think that you do.
Yeah. And there's this trope that as you like move from in, you know, up this like management ladder, that control increases. And it totally doesn't. It's inverse. Your CEO has so much less control over outcomes than you do as a line manager. Like, it's wild how little control you have the higher you move up into an organization. And your position moves from, like, at a line manager, you're sort of contextualizing and persuading. And then you get up to CEO and you're just begging, oh my God, please. Please ship this feature. This matters so much to our business. Can somebody please give us this thing?
Or more charitably, the further you move up the organizational hierarchy, the more time you spend doing things like vision casting and painting this vision of what the future could be, and then working to get the organization underneath you aligned towards that vision. But really, it's just begging.
It is like persuasion based begging. Well, on that note, it's probably a good time to wrap up, but I really enjoyed this topic. I think about this a lot, like I was saying earlier. I learned a lot just in this conversation, and there was a lot that I want to take back to my team now. There are things that I'm literally in the middle of right now that I want to take back and ponder on how I can relinquish some of that control. Like, what can I let the team take that I've been holding on to? I think anybody that's listening to this probably has that rolling around in their back of their head, that there's probably something you're holding on to. And if your question is, gosh, how do I have my team become self-managing? You already know the answer. That's it. Let it go, baby.
Yeah, I think that's the key takeaway. So much of it is in what you choose to hang on to and what you're able to make yourself let go. And that actually has far more to do with any of this than what your team is willing to take on.
Yeah, they'll surprise you. If you can do that, you'll surprise them and then they'll surprise you. Well, with that, everyone, thank you so much for listening. We love when we get listener suggestions from you all. We've gotten a few of them and we have a few in the backlog and we hope to talk to them soon. And if you have questions for us specifically, you can reach out to us at Managing Up Show on Twitter, or you can reach out to us individually. I am Ted Viking on Twitter.
I'm N Means on Twitter.
And I am T Swicegood most everywhere.
And we would love it if you would rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and join us again next time. Bye, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
See you.